Okay, I think it's time for us to get started again. Any questions or comments pertaining to the discussion prior to the break? Okay, well, let me begin by explaining this point three, the myth of past pure and perfect competition. This relates to the allegation that today most of the economy, the great bulk of the economy, is tainted by some element of monopoly, and only a very small, modest portion represents full-bodied competition. Some means has to be found of reconciling this idea with the general public perception that most things represent competition, that monopoly is the exceptional case and competition is the normal case. And how do we reconcile that with the attitudes of contemporary economic theory that claim that practically everything is some element or other of monopoly? Well, the means of reconciling the public perception with contemporary economic theory is what I refer to as the myth of past pure and perfect competition. It's argued that the reason that people think that competition is the normal case is because for a long time it was. But when did that time ended? A long time ago. And the period in which competition as the norm allegedly came to an end was in the late decades of the 19th century. The period following the Civil War was the period of the great growth of big business, the era of the trusts, so-called. And it was argued that prior to this time, pure and perfect competition was very widespread. There were an enormous number of producers in most lines of production. It was only after the Civil War that we got the great growth of big business and the great reduction in the number of producers in many industries. Now, I want to point out that in the era before the Civil War, it may well have been the case that had we counted up the number of butchers across the country and counted up the number of ironmongers and blacksmiths and so forth, and the number of sawmills and on, we might well have come up with larger totals in pre-1860 than post-1880. But this would not have meant that there was more competition. Because just consider what was the state of the transportation system in the decades prior to the Civil War compared with the decades following the Civil War. Well, there was some, but it was not nearly as advanced as it came to be in the decades following the Civil War. The decades following the Civil War were the major era of railroad building. Thousands of miles of railway were constructed each year. There was also the era in which we got steam-powered ocean-going vessels. Now, in the era before the Civil War, each little locale would have its own butcher shop, maybe some limited capability of producing iron. Would the butcher shops or butcher plants of one locale be in a position to compete with those 100 miles away?
No.
Not with a primitive state of transportation. Just as today, we don't have too much competition among brick producers, or not as much across a wide area as with many other products, because the transportation cost is so heavy relative to the value of the product. Well, so we may have had a larger absolute numbers, larger absolute number of producers in many industries before the Civil War, but very, very few of them were in actual competition with one another. If you have one producer in each of 1,000 towns and villages, so there are 1,000 overall, that doesn't mean we have 1,000 in competition. In any given town or village, there may be just one. Then in a later era, when instead of having 1,000 small, inefficient producers, we have 3, 4, or 5 very large ones, but those 3, 4, or 5 are in a position to compete over the full breadth of the country, or most of it, then there's more actual competition going on. There are more firms in actual competition with one another, even though the overall total of the firms may be drastically reduced. So the idea that it's reasonable for people to think the economy was competitive because we had so many more producers at one time, and now it's monopolistic because we have much fewer, that really defies the actual situation. People are thinking of everything as tainted with monopoly, not because of changes in the actual facts, which if anything go in the opposite direction, but because of changes in economic theory, which have developed these new concepts, new since the 1930s, of oligopoly and monopolistic competition. All right, let me deal with the significance of monopoly on the economic concept. And there are a range of different aspects of significance, ranging from the near terrifying to the laughable. And let me briefly touch on each of them to indicate the scope of what's involved. The most dire, what I refer to as the near terrifying, is an alleged tendency in the absence of government intervention toward the formation of a single giant firm controlling the entire economic system. I think it's widely believed that if we did not have the antitrust laws, there'd be no limit to the merger process, that IBM and Dell would merge, General Motors and Toyota would merge, Nippon Steel would merge with U.S. Steel, would merge with this new major Indian steel firm that's recently bought up a lot of our abandoned steel firms. And then they'd all merge together. Allegedly, the bigger fish would be swallowing the smaller fish. In turn, those bigger fish would be swallowed by still bigger fish. And the ultimate outcome would be one super gigantic firm running the entire economic system, if we didn't have the antitrust laws. I think that's a widely held fear. Yes, Kumar.
Even after monopolistic laws and antitrust laws, the diamond company, they continue to exist, right?
Pardon me?
Even after all these laws, the diamond company,
De Beers, yeah, the diamond cartel.
They continue to operate.
Oh, they still exist, yes.
They are monopolies, so.
Yeah, that's a cartel. You have a diamond cartel, and they still function. But what we're talking about here, we'll deal with cartels as a separate subcase.
Okay.
But we want to touch on the various alleged aspects of significance of monopoly. And the most dire is an alleged tendency toward the formation of one super combine running the entire world. Now, closely related to that, partly as a means of achieving it, unlimited mergers is one mechanism, but closely related to that, as a means of contributing to the formation of a super combine, is the alleged practice of predatory pricing. And this is the notion that a large, rich firm is in a position to cut its prices, run at a loss, which it can afford because it's supposedly big and rich, and its poorer, smaller competitor can't afford the loss because he's small and poor, and the big rich firms will simply drive the small poor firms out of existence, and once they've done so, they'll jack their prices up to higher levels than ever before. This is a doctrine that's significant in its own right, but it also plays a role as one of the means working toward the formation of the giant super combine. Allegedly, to the extent it's not achieved through mergers, it'll be achieved through the practice of predatory pricing. But even putting aside the super combine doctrine, the predatory pricing doctrine deserves to be considered as significant in its own right, even if it doesn't lead to a super combine, it's worth looking at and considering if it might apply in isolated instances of particular industries. So we'll look at that. I don't know if we'll get to that tonight, but certainly by next week. There's the doctrine that I refer to as the doctrine of marginal revenue and higher prices in the single industry. This is also a doctrine raised in criticism of big business on the grounds that a large business, a business large in relation to its overall market, is concerned with the effects of its action on the price of the supply that it's already selling, and that it will not wish to expand its production, which would entail having a lower price, because of the effect of the price reduction on the quantity it's already selling. It's argued that such firms are not interested in a comparison of the selling price of their product with the cost of producing it, but rather in a comparison of the marginal revenue, the extra revenue, the additional revenue, positive or negative, in comparison with the cost of producing their product. We'll look at that doctrine also. And then there's the cartel doctrine, that there's a significant problem with different independent firms in various industries joining together to limit their production for the purpose of achieving a higher price. And then finally, there's the pure and perfect competition doctrine. And this is the doctrine that I had in mind when I said that some aspects of the alleged significance of monopoly on the economic concept are actually laughable. This is the one that I think is laughable. But we'll get to this next week. Let's start with the near terrifying, and that's the alleged tendency toward the formation of a single giant firm. And this doctrine has even been depicted in works of art. You can see paintings in some places showing larger fish swallowing smaller fish, in turn being swallowed by still bigger fish, as representing what would happen to the economic system, what's expected to happen. Now, this doctrine was played a very important role in the teachings of Marx and his followers. It served as the underpinning for a major doctrine of Marxism, which is the alleged inevitability of socialism. We might find that that doctrine is rather peculiar today, since so many countries that had been socialist have abandoned it, including the Soviet Union and the East European satellites. But if we could bring ourselves back just 15 years, or a little more than that, if you were looking at the world before 1989, there was this enormous communist bloc. And over the years, it had been continually adding territory. As recently as the 1970s, it was feared that Southern Europe would end up in the communist bloc. They were expanding in Southeast Asia. It was thought that time went on, more and more of the world would come under the sway of socialism. And within each country, there were powerful political parties, and still are, working to expand government control and power. And it was widely feared, and still is, and with some considerable justification, that this works in the direction of socialism. But many, many people thought, as an empirical matter, that the coming of socialism is irresistible. It's just progressing, and there's nothing we can do about it. As I say, that notion has received a huge setback with the fall of the socialist regimes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and also major inroads even in mainland China. Now, nevertheless, this doctrine of the alleged tendency toward the formation of a supergiant firm played an important role in buttressing this doctrine. Because what the Marxists had to say was that if we do nothing, if everyone just stands back and lets capitalism develop according to its own laws of development, where will it end up? Suppose the government does nothing. The government has a hands-off, laissez-faire policy. What will allegedly happen in terms of mergers and the practice of predatory pricing?
They'll go totally out of control.
And it'll be totally out of control, and where will it end?
With the overthrow of capitalism.
Pardon me?
With the overthrow of capitalism.
Well, before it gets to the overthrow, what will exist on the last day of capitalism?
Nothing.
Pardon me?
Wouldn't it be one huge firm?
Yeah, the supergiant combine. The supergiant combine. It's thought that if the government does nothing, we end up with this supergiant combine. And this gave great comfort to the Marxists, because if that really were to happen, if we were in fact to end up with a supergiant combine, how would that last day of capitalism differ from the first day of socialism? I'm just thinking, in what way would a supergiant combine differ from socialism? In what way would it closely resemble socialism? Yes, Mr. Underwood?
Wouldn't there be one owner?
Yeah, there'd be one owner. All of the means of production would be under unitary control. There'd be one board of directors running the entire economic system. That's what would happen if we had one giant combine. Yes, Ms. Fox?
They would, with one supercombine, they would run it as to make a profit, whereas with socialism, the government owned the company.
Okay, they presumably would be attempting to make a profit from it. That's true. Now, I make a reference here. General Bull Moose rules the world. I don't know how current that is anymore, but years ago there was a very popular comic strip called Little Abner. In fact, there was even a Broadway play called Little Abner. And one of the characters who came in and out of the strip every few years was an old croc named General Bull Moose. And he was this very imposing figure who you could visualize sitting at the head of a 100-yard-long board of directors table, pounding his fist on it. And he was always projected as, if there's any cash or other worthwhile asset that is not yet in his control, he's out to get it. So I always visualized him as being the chairman of the board of directors of this super combine. And there'd be other negative characters on the board, perhaps such as Leona Helmsley, who many people haven't liked, and anyone else you can think of with a very bad public reputation, who's known for being a greedy pig capitalist. There'd be a handful of them on the board of directors. And here they are. They're in control of the economic system. And as Ms. Fox pointed out, what is their purpose and motive in running the economic system? Well, their own personal power, profit, aggrandizement. And now, what will happen when they're displaced? See, if things develop to that point, the transition from capitalism to socialism would only involve changing the membership of the board of directors. So here we are, we have this board of directors consisting of selfish meanies, and we'll then have a new board of directors on the first day of socialism, consisting of perhaps such people as Ralph Nader, Jane Fonda, Tom Hayden, the Reverend Jackson, and they'll be running the economic system, not for their own personal selfish aggrandizement, but for the good of all mankind. Maybe not these specific individuals, but I think I give you the drift of the idea. Now, let me point out that, before I get to that, this alleged tendency toward the establishment of a supergiant combine, this made it appear that the establishment of socialism was a kind of relatively modest step from fully developed capitalism. Marx always liked to argue that each new economic system is the hatches out of the womb, and these are his words, comes out of the womb of the previous economic system. So he argued that in an earlier period of history, capitalism developed out of feudalism. And then in the future, socialism, along such lines as I've just indicated, will develop out of capitalism. So each step, it's not such a total violent rupture with the past, it's a natural development of conditions that build up in the maturation of the preceding economic system. Now this view, which was so important and very popular with the Marxists, is also shared by most of the opponents of Marx. And in fact, played a major role in the enactment of our antitrust laws. Anti-communist, anti-socialists believe the same doctrine. And Senator Sherman, when he was presenting the Sherman Antitrust Act on the floor of the Senate back in 1890, argued that it was necessary to enact the Antitrust Act in order to forestall the communists and socialists, to prevent the development of conditions that would culminate in communism or socialism, to stop this tendency toward the formation of a supergiant combine. And so there are many, many people, I think, who support these laws, not because they are Marxists, but they do agree that this would be the outcome of capitalism. They don't want capitalism to reach the point where there's only one board of directors. And so they think the antitrust laws are necessary to prevent that. Am I telling you something you haven't heard before in some form or other? Yes, no?
No.
Okay, I wouldn't think so. But sometimes I do encounter students who've totally missed the fallacies they were supposed to have been taught. I don't know how that may happen sometimes, but it does. Evidently not here. I'm sorry?
Maybe it's good sometimes not to pay attention.
Well, you should be paying attention. Good to take a lot with a grain of salt or a whole pound of salt. Now, you find intimations of this doctrine sometimes. There are books that have been written, this is now some years ago, claiming, for example, that 40 families controlled the economy of the United States. 40 wealthy families. And if you would have the heiress of one family marrying the heir of another such family, there are people around who'd be viewing this as a step toward more interlocking control, ultimately working in the direction of the outcome we've described. Now, let me point out that the only time in the history of the world that there has been any formation of a super combine has been with the establishment of socialism. Only under socialism do you actually have such conditions. And wherever this has been done, the combine, the socialist combine, has been established by means of force and violence. Millions of separate independent property owners who are forcibly dispossessed, their property seized, and that's what created the unitary socialist control. And then the only thing that maintained the unitary socialist control was the continued use of force, the continued making of production into a legal government monopoly. I don't know if you're aware, in the Soviet Union, any type of private economic activity was a serious criminal offense that could result in death in many periods. If you bought flowers, let's say, in southern Russia, and you carried them with you to Moscow, perhaps, and then you sold them in Moscow for more than you had paid for them in Odessa, that was a criminal offense. That was a crime of speculation. It was against the law for any private individual to hire and to employ the labor of any other private individual. And the underlying rationale of that was that any employment of labor is the exploitation of labor. They're not going to allow that. So all private economic activity was forcibly suppressed. Now, if it had not been, even if we began with a socialist government controlling the entire economy, its control would quickly come to be diminished, and in not too many years, largely evaporate. And you can see this going on in mainland China today. The percentage of the Chinese economy that is conducted in private hands has been very rapidly growing from year to year. And I think today it's probably more than half of their economic system. Similarly, in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, if not forcibly suppressed, private ownership and private economic activity tends to develop, because that is what is personally profitable to people. Now, just think, you have the socialist government in control of all of the means of production. If they were not forcibly suppressing it, suppose you are lucky enough to have some kind of appliance, and it's not working. But if you take it to the government repair facility, maybe you have to wait 6 months, but they never repair it, they don't know how to repair it. Certainly there could be private individuals who could do such things and who would meet your needs. And so what would happen if they were not forcibly suppressed? When you immediately start having a private business activity in such lines, in restaurants, all kinds of small businesses. What would happen to the extent these operations were successful and the people running them made some significant profits? What would that put them in a position to start doing?
Competing with the government.
To start competing on an expanded scale, get into more and more things. Now, here's the government that controls the whole economy, but how well is it able to do anything? Not very well. So you could not maintain this monolithic monopoly in the absence of prohibitions on private economic activity starting up and intensifying. Now, furthermore, there is no tendency toward the formation of such an arrangement under capitalism. There is no tendency toward the formation of any kind of single giant combine. And we can deal, I refer to a critique of the merger route up in point four at the top of the page. There are a number of considerations that work against any such development. And the first is that it goes against the nature of the advantages of the division of labor. The whole nature of a division of labor is for people to specialize, to limit their activities to certain lines, not to attempt to do everything. And that same point applies to the activities of business firms. It does not pay a business firm to be in too many lines. And again, when firms attempt to get into too many lines, they engage in bad mergers, mergers that diminish their profitability, and then they have to spin off the acquisitions. And there's quite a few such cases. Looking over not too many years, Novell bought WordPerfect at one point, I think, for about $800 million. And then what did they have to do not many years after? Spin it off, I think, for about $40 million. Montgomery Ward was acquired for a time by Mobil before it merged with Exxon. And Mobil ended up having to get rid of it at a loss. And Montgomery Ward has since totally gone out of existence. Sears attempted to get into the real estate business and the stock brokerage business and was not doing very well in those lines and subsequently got out of those operations. So there are many, many situations where you have mergers and acquisitions, and if they're not undertaken judiciously, if a firm gets involved in lines of business that it really doesn't have the necessary competence, it loses by doing that, and it ends up having to get out at a loss. We had, I think, was it Sony? Was that the firm that bought Rockefeller Center? Or some other major Japanese firm, not too many years back, bought Rockefeller Center in New York City. Does anyone remember which firm it was?
It was RCA.
It was a Japanese firm that bought Rockefeller Center. I don't know if they also acquired RCA in the process. The RCA building is part of Rockefeller Center. But in any case, some years later, they had to get out at a very substantial loss. We have important cases of divestitures, spin-offs. We had, after AT&T had to lose the local Bells, it was still a very substantial company, but then they spinned off Lucent, and then Lucent in turn has spin off, was it Avaya, is it called? So you have this phenomenon. Then there's a closely related phenomenon, the leveraged buyouts, and breakups. There have been people, I guess more in the 90s than recently, who were specializing in buying up companies. They'd borrow a lot of money to do so. And then they broke up these companies that they acquired. They sold off divisions, particular factories, particular locations, and they were able to liquidate them in pieces for substantially more money than they had paid for the firm as a unit. Now, you would think that the those who fear mergers and predatory pricing and all the rest, you would think that they would applaud developments of this kind because they're working in the diametrically opposite direction. But what is the conventional reaction to leverage buyouts and breakups?
Puts people out of work, so it's bad.
That's bad too. So the mergers are bad, the breakup of the mergers, that's bad too. You can't do it right no matter how you try. Now, so this is just to point out that we shouldn't expect any tendency toward unlimited mergers. They often do not work out. Certain conditions have to be met before a merger will be worthwhile, and there are many, many cases when you lose by having a merger. Then a related point, B, I say prospects. The talented can't be merged. Let me elaborate on what I mean by that. In order to have a voluntary merger, all of the parties to the merger have to expect that they will be better off as the result of the merger than they are on their own. Well, how likely do you think that belief is going to be on the part of people who are very optimistic and confident about their own future success? To take an illustration, suppose someone had wanted to carry out a merger in the computer industry, let's say 10, 15 years ago, that would have included Michael Dell. Now, at that time, Dell was not a very significant player. He started selling computers out of his dorm room at the University of Texas. So suppose you had encountered him a few years out of school. Maybe he's made his first few million by then. And I assume he would have some kind of vision of his future success. What would he need to get Michael Dell into a merger of the computer industry to make it more worth his while to join the merged operation than to remain independent?
Put him in charge.
You'd have to provide him a better prospect.
You'd have to offer him more than he could expect to accomplish on his own. Well, do you think that a merger would be possible on that basis? If here you are, I think back around 1985, or a little later, when the IBM PS2s came out, there was a brief period, a little bit before, around 1985, I guess, when the 8286 was the cutting edge processor, the 8286. At that point, for a limited time, IBM was selling about 55% of the new computers. That didn't last very long. Now, do you think it would have been possible to arrange a merger At that point, between IBM, Compaq, and Dell, if the people who were running Compaq, or Compaq was very new then, but I assume that those people had some great vision too. So, if here you are, you have the management of Compaq thinking that in not too many years, they're going to be bigger than IBM in the sale of personal computers, and Dell thinking that in not too many more years, they'll be as big or bigger than Compaq. How does IBM get together with such people in a merger? How do you make it worth IBM's while to agree to a merger in which the other parties expect to be largely enriched by virtue of having a huge chunk of IBM's business? You think IBM is prepared to give them that business now? Are they prepared to sign on terms that are agreeable to IBM? You don't have the conditions for a merger anytime you have people who believe that on their own they will do much better than in the merger. And this is the case, I think, again and again. Anytime you have optimistic independent producers who think that in some years they'll be a major factor, the conditions of a merger are simply not present. I think this is the case again and again, very, very often. And there's an application of this to conglomerates. I've made the point that not every company's management is capable of doing performing in every line of business. Each company's management is limited to one or a few lines of business that they can handle with any competence. But you might wonder, okay, why not have a conglomerate in which we'll have different divisions with separate managements? So we'll have competent managements running different parts of the conglomerate. That would be seem to be a more reasonable arrangement. But even so, I would say the conditions for achieving that are often, or for the most part, not present. Now, why not? Well, just think, what is a common outlook among business executives on their own future? If they have any kind of error, what kind of error do you think it is? That they're excessive pessimists or excessive optimists? I would think excessive optimists. Well, suppose a widely prevailing attitude of executives is that if their company remains in their control within 10 years, instead of having its present share of the market, it will have a substantially larger share of the market. Instead of perhaps representing 10% of the market in 10 or 20 years under their skillful leadership, it'll account for 40 or 50% of the market. Now, what do you think they will want to do? Will they prefer to have an arrangement whereby what they do, their operation, is under their control, and to the extent they succeed, they get a major share of the profits? Or instead, enter an arrangement in which they are part of a much, much larger operation that is not significantly under their control, and in which the earnings that they will obtain will be determined by the performance of others that they don't control and whose judgment they probably regard as inferior to their own.
They want to stand alone.
I would think they want to stand alone. I don't think you could have gotten successful executives in any line who believe in their own future. They have to believe that they will do better on their own in conditions in which their activities are under their control and they will have a substantial share of the profits versus entering into an arrangement where their activities are largely controlled by others and they have a small share of a much larger operation. I don't think you'll get such people to merge. And so you don't have the basis for the widespread development of these conglomerates. There is some basis for the conglomerates, but I think we'll see that when we get into the discussion of taxation. Now, further, it should be realized that when there are successful mergers, and there certainly are cases in which there are economically proper mergers, in which it's the reasonable thing to do, when a merger is successful, what is the effect on the wealth of the participating investors? It increases, so their wealth is greater. And an indirect consequence of this is that they are then in a better position to launch new firms, not necessarily new firms in their own industry, but new firms somewhere in the economy. So if, for example, you have a period in which there are successful mergers in the steel industry that serves to enrich the participating firms and their stockholders, the result is that these people are now in a better position to provide financing for a new firm, not necessarily in the steel industry, but maybe a new firm in the oil industry, or the aluminum industry, or God knows where, somewhere else in the economy. And similarly, suppose you have successful mergers in various other industries, like we have successful mergers in the oil industry. Well, that gives those investors the additional capital to launch new firms elsewhere also. And if this is a broadly based phenomenon, then and you have new capital being formed in a wide number of different industries, the investors in which are all in a position to launch more new firms, then you're in a position, not too many years later, to have new firms launched in all the different industries. So even after there's a merger in the steel industry, the additional capital created in a variety of industries lays the foundation for the formation of more new firms back in the steel industry, and similarly in the various other industries. So the very success of successful mergers is to create the capital which serves as the foundation for more new firms throughout the economic system. And then there is the fact that there are more new firms being formed throughout the economy. In any case, year after year, we have many thousands of new firms formed in the economy each year. Most of them don't last very long. Most of them are gone before they reach the age of five. But there are some which make it to medium size, and there are some of those that then make it to very large size. And if you stop and consider the Fortune 500, for example, today, and you were to compare the Fortune 500 with the firms on it 25 years ago, let alone 50 years ago, you'd find that there's a major change in the makeup. Microsoft is one of the top firms today. But where was Microsoft on the Fortune 500 in 1979? They weren't. Where was Dell?
Wasn't there
Where was Hewlett Packard Compaq?
HP might have been video.
Well, if they were, they would have been much further down the list. Compaq wouldn't have been on it at all. I don't know if the Fortune 500 is international or not, but where would Honda and Nissan and Toyota have been on the list? If at all, pretty far down. On the other hand, where would U.S. Steel and Bethlehem Steel have been? Pretty high up. We have many firms that were extremely prominent not all that long ago. The New York Central Railroad, the Pennsylvania Railroad. These are companies that have ceased to exist. Pan American Airlines, Trans World Airlines. These are major firms that I think not all that long ago would have made the Fortune 500. They don't even exist anymore. Kodak is way down. Polaroid, I don't know if they've gone into bankruptcy. I think they have. Maybe I'm mistaken. The system is still pretty dynamic, and the greatest fortunes, the biggest firms, they tend to be of relatively recent origin. and the leading firms and fortunes of a previous generation, they tend to recede, if not go out of existence altogether. Now, the degree of dynamism in the economy could be considerably greater than it is. It's been a long time since we've had a new domestic automobile firm. We've had new entrants into the automobile industry, but they're foreign companies. The last new American automobile firm that's still around was Chrysler, and it entered, I think, sometime in the 1930s. We could have new firms in practically every branch of industry, despite the very, very high capital requirements. Let's say it takes $1 billion to get into, to open up shop in the auto industry. Let's grant that. It's usually assumed that it's just impossible to raise the necessary funds, that an upstart firm just can't do it. There are conditions in which it could do it. Just think, who would be the logical nucleus, who would be the nucleus to lead a new firm in almost any line of industry, such as the auto industry? Where would the nucleus of such a firm come from? Where does the nucleus of new firms come from in the computer industry, in the software industry?
Management from other
Yeah, people from previously established firms, they're not satisfied with their future there. Some senior executives, talented younger people, they decide to pack up and leave, start their own company. And that's been pretty common in software, in computers too, likely to be less common perhaps in the future. But you could have that as a permanent phenomenon in practically all branches of the economy. Now, even in those branches in which you need a huge capital investment, imagine that we could have 20 key auto industry executives, some senior vice presidents, some plant general managers, people of this kind. What would be required? Would it be possible, do you think, for a nucleus of, say, 20 key executives from one or more automobile firms, between them to have, say, $250 million?
Sure.
Today they might not, but could you imagine conditions in which this would not be such a hurdle? What sorts of changes would we need so it would not be so incredible for 10 or 20 key executives already well established personally to be worth among them $250 million?
The economy would have to improve as a
whole. We say the economy improve as a whole. Well,
buyers in the market to buy up those cars that great profits to those companies.
Well, is there anything before a major change in the whole economy like that, and then if you had that, there could be other factors working in a different way. Maybe the size automobile plant you would need would require $2 billion or $5 billion. What could be done within the framework of our present economy that would make it possible for key executives to accumulate substantial personal fortunes? Pardon me?
No taxes.
Yeah, if we didn't have the income tax, or if the top rate were modest, if you had a modest top rate of the income tax, and you have people who are earning salaries over a period of quite a few years in the high six figures, well, they'd be in a position to save very, very heavily, to invest it wisely, make good rates of return. And then also, I know here I'll certainly lose many of you, and you'll perhaps find it shocking and outrageous. Suppose we didn't have the kind of insider stock restrictions, stock trading restrictions that we have. Key executives within firms have inside knowledge. They'd be in a position to trade their firm's stock very successfully and accumulate a great deal of money that way. Now, I don't want to attempt to address all of the objections to that, but I do want to point out that that would provide the nucleus for the foundation of new firms in many, many industries. It would be something That would greatly intensify the degree of competition. It would contribute to the personal wealth of key executives. And if we had 10 or 20 key executives worth $250 million on their own, well, that is enough of a nucleus of capital, I would think, to go out and raise the remaining $750 million or whatever that would be required to launch a new firm. Okay.
No question.
All right. If anyone is interested, I have a discussion of insider trading in Chapter 10 on this very issue. And I point out that I have trouble identifying any serious losers, any real losers by this. But if you're interested, you'll find the discussion there. Now, let's turn, and also we need to realize that anything that prevents the accumulation, the rapid accumulation of capital by new upstart firms gives the established firms a degree of protection to the extent that new upstart firms are prevented from accumulating capital. That acts as a kind of monopoly protection for the already established firms. Something similar, perhaps even more potent, is government regulation that requires the employment of staffs of lawyers and accountants and compliance officers. If you're General Motors or IBM and there's some new regulation enacted, well, to respond to it, you need now to hire a few new attorneys. You need to have a few more accounts, a few more compliance officers. It's not such a big deal for a huge organization like that. But suppose you have a relatively small upstart firm that has maybe half a dozen executives, and they're saddled with the same regulations. Can they afford to go out and hire a new staff of accountants, lawyers, compliance officers? Such legislation operates to give a kind of advantage to the established firms. They can afford these additional costs, but a small new firm just can't. It'll cripple its management. And that provides a kind of shelter to the already established large firms. The tax system, this is now point E, the tax system has, over the years, provided a stimulus to uneconomic mergers. It's led to already large firms expanding into lines they otherwise would not have expanded simply for tax considerations. Now, this changes as the capital gains tax rate changes, but to whatever extent the capital gains tax is substantially below the personal and corporate income tax, or at least the personal income tax, it can operate as an incentive to mergers that would otherwise not be worth carrying out. Now, this would be truer when the rates were, when the tax rates were higher. It diminishes as tax rates go down. But let's deal with the time when the personal income tax was as high as 70%. And I think it was as recently as Reagan taking office. Reagan was the president that reduced the top rates to, briefly they got down to about 28% for the federal personal income tax. But they had been 70% on dividend and interest income prior to his taking office.
It was just on dividend and interest.
Yeah, now wages and salaries, I think the top rate capped out at 50%. That had also been 70%, I believe, until Nixon took office. In fact, in World War II and the years immediately following World War II, the maximum surtax was 90%. Now, it's also true there were more loopholes at the time, too. But there were some people who couldn't take advantage of the loopholes and who ended up being socked with the full rates. Well, just imagine that here you are, you're in an environment There's a very high corporate income tax. At one time, I think that was 42%, maybe even higher than 42%. And then whatever profits the corporation earned and paid out to stockholders, that could be taxed as high as 70% at the federal level, and then kick in the state. That's another 10% in many jurisdictions. Now, at the same time, the capital gains tax was on the order of about 25%. So that's much less severe. All right, well now, suppose we have a corporation. It's competent in its existing line of business. It's making good profits. It has wealthy stockholders. But if it distributes its high profits to these stockholders, they'll be faced with humongous tax bills. Well, there's a way to reduce the tax burden, and that would be to use these profits to acquire other firms. If you acquire the other firms, and if you don't run them into the ground, if you can make some profit from them, well, what should be the effect on the value of your stock?
Increased.
It should go up. The stock should be worth more now. And if your big stockholders have held their stock for more than 6 months, or whatever the qualifying period is, to get capital gains tax treatment, well then, in effect, the additional the profits of the firm in being used to acquire the assets of other firms and raise the value of the stock, instead of being paid out as a dividend, whereby the stockholders may have to pay 70%, if instead the same profits serve to enhance the value of the stock via the acquisition of other firms, then the wealthy stockholders can obtain a payout by selling some of their shares at an enhanced price. And on the profit they realize, on the capital gain they realize on the sale of their shares, they're only paying a 25% tax instead of a 70% tax. Well, such a tax arrangement provides an incentive to mergers that would otherwise not occur. Firms make mergers as a means of tax avoidance for wealthy stockholders. And for very similar considerations, there are firms that are led to sell out for the same reason. Imagine you've developed a firm, let's say to medium size, and you're now personally worth $40 or $50 million, and one of the things you'd like to do is build a mansion. Your mansion will cost $5 million. Well, if you were living in an environment in which you had to pay 70% income taxes, to clear $5 million, you'd have to have a dividend of roughly three times that. You'd have to take a dividend of $15 million, give the government 10, and now you have five left for your mansion. But if instead you can find someone who wants to buy your firm and you sell it out and record it as a capital gain, well, then maybe you can have your mansion by only liquidating $6.25 million or $7 million of stock instead of having to take $15 million. You're reducing the tax burden by entering into a merger. So this is a non-economic merger, which is encouraged by the tax system, which occurs only because of the tax system. And then finally, the tax code allows you to offset profits with losses. So if you can acquire a firm that has substantial accumulated losses, its very record of losses gives it some value. Whoever buys the loss-making firm is able to take its losses and deduct them from its profits. So that's a merger or acquisition that really has no basis other than tax considerations. Now, I want to turn briefly to positive reasons for mergers, point five. Very often, mergers make possible the introduction of more division of labor. If you produce on a larger scale, you can define smaller tasks. Any given size task that has to be done on an absolutely larger scale, you can have more specialization in that task. To take a very simple type of example, suppose you have a production line, and there is an operation in producing a product that takes 1 minute. There's a particular operation in producing a product that takes 1 minute to perform. Now, if you only produce one unit of that product per day, that operation certainly can't be anyone's full-time job. If you produce 100 units of that product in a day, it still can't be anyone's full-time job. And it's not going to be very likely that it'll pay to have a special tool or machine, or it'll be much less likely to pay to have a special tool or machine to help in doing that limited operation if it's relatively infrequent. Well, suppose you could produce on a larger scale, so you're not producing one unit or 100 units. Suppose you're producing several hundred units a day. In fact, suppose you're now producing 480 units a day. Well, with 480 units a day, what can be done with this one-minute operation? That would not be feasible with a lower volume of output. Pardon me?
It's made one man's job.
Yeah, it can be someone's full-time job. And at the same time, you also have a specialized tool or machine in constant use, so it's more economical to use. You have greater division of labor to the extent that you're able to isolate particular small tasks and perform them on a volume large enough to make them into full-time jobs. That's more division of labor. You're able to get fuller use of machines and tools. So there are mergers and acquisitions that are very worthwhile, that make a lot of sense insofar as they permit production on a larger scale in a more efficient way along these lines. Now also, there can be good rationale for mergers and acquisitions when you have unequal managements, when you have firms in the same line, but one of the firms has a much better management than some of the other firms. If the firm with the better management can acquire the assets of the firms with a poorer management, they can apply the better management over more assets. And we have more assets operated with more managerial skill. So a merger can make sense in those conditions. Sometimes the larger operation can have a significant advantage by having better access to the capital market. If you're a very small firm, you're not in a position to sell shares on a stock exchange. If you're somewhat larger, perhaps significantly larger, then you may be able to. You can probably arrange bank loans on better terms also. There are cases in which different firms may have complementary products. And when a salesman of one of them goes around making calls, many of the customers are always asking for products that are provided by another. Well, it would make good sense to have a merger in a case like this, so you'd make better use of the salesman's time. You can have sometimes economies with respect to advertising. This may not be such a factor today, where you have cable television that can very narrowly zero in on small neighborhoods. So you might have very local restaurants advertising to a limited audience on cable television. But suppose you're talking about conventional radio or television over the airwaves. Does it pay an isolated small restaurant likely to have advertising on the local CBS affiliate? I don't think that would be a worthwhile procedure, because most of the people hearing the ad would not be in the market of the restaurant. But now, what about McDonald's advertising over local radio or the local affiliate of CBS? Well, they have enough outlets so that the great majority of the people hearing their advertising will at least be within their local market areas. So an advantage of McDonald's having the number of outlets it has, one of the advantages, I'm sure there are many others that are far more significant, but one of the advantages is economies with respect to the utilization of advertising money. Now, I have a special reference here to transportation economies. And we'll see that that was perhaps the most important factor in the growth of big business in the era following the Civil War, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. Now, the usual, I'm now up to point six, truth about the 19th century. If you had, if you're up playing a game like Wheel of Fortune, and there was a question, I don't think they ask such questions, but you just have words on plaques. An epithet for the big businessmen of the late 19th century was what? Pardon me?
What was the question?
An epithet for the leading businessmen of the late 19th century was a two-word description.
Oh, robber barons.
Robber barons, the robber barons, the robber barons. Now, the meaning of robber barons is these businessmen made their fortunes by some kind of process of robbery. Now, I think I already have attacked this last week, or certainly should have, but there we were dealing with, well, it's a similar issue, but a popular line of attack was that the big businessmen, if they were not busy extorting, imposing arbitrarily low wages on their workers, making money by starving the workers, what was their other source of lucre? Gouging the general buying public through raising prices. And the implication was the formation of trusts, and trusts, as I'll point out, were the first major merger device that came into being with the growth of big business. The belief was the formation of trusts, the development of big business, this was only done in order to be in a position to raise prices and gouge the consumers. And that's how the robber barons were allegedly, well, one of the main ways that the robber barons were allegedly robbing the humble citizens. Now, the industries in which we had the trusts and the development of big business, these were such industries as petroleum, sugar refining, steel, cement production, rubber, railroads, meat packing, flour milling, pretty much the broad spectrum of American industry. Now, if in fact these big businesses had been acting monopolistically and raising prices, what should we expect to have been happening to the volume of output in those industries?
Decrease.
It should have been going down. How does a true monopoly enhance its profits?
Less.
They're producing less and selling it for more, selling it at a higher price. Nevertheless, what was happening to the actual volume of production in the United States in practically every year following the Civil War, down to World War I, which is the era of these developments, what was happening to the volume of production in practically every industry, and first and foremost in the industries that the trusts were prominent in?
Increasing.
Pardon me?
Increase?
It was very sharply increasing. This era was probably the era of most rapid economic growth in the history of the United States. And what was happening to prices over most of this period, down from, let's say, 1873 down to 1896? What was actually happening to the prices of practically everything? they were sharply falling. And as a matter of fact, I may have already mentioned that the statistics show that by the end of the 19th century, prices were approximately 50% of what they had been at the end of the 18th century. And prices were particularly much lower of such steel, such products as steel and petroleum and cement and flour and all of the other things where the development of big business had proceeded. So the actual historical facts are opposite to what you should have expected if, in fact, there had been growing monopoly going on. Now, let me turn to the trust movement, which I describe here as the earliest merger device. The corporate form of business only became prominent in the decades subsequent to the Civil War. Before the Civil War, corporations were limited to railroading and insurance. That was about it. And in order to form a corporation, you needed to have a special act of a state legislature. And so the prevailing method of doing business before the Civil War was sole proprietorships and partnerships. But as businesses were attempting to get larger and operate on a larger scale, the partnership arrangements became increasingly complex. I mean, it's one thing to have a small business with two or three partners. That can endure for a long time. When one of the partners wants out or dies, you need to then redraw the partnership agreement. A partnership arrangement is really not feasible where you would have hundreds of partners. Too many of them can want out at any given time. There's going to be some of them dying off. So that's just not a feasible arrangement. And in recognition of those difficulties, starting, I think, around 1870, first the states of New Jersey and Delaware greatly simplified the ability to form a corporation. They made it pretty much the kind of routine matter that it is today and that we all take for granted. You meet some conditions, you fill out some forms, and you're off and running. So I go into this because the corporate form of doing business was relatively new, and things had not been worked out in all respects, particularly with one corporation attempting to merge with other corporations. And the trusts were the first device hit upon to make possible the merger of corporations. And the way the trusts would work is the arrangement would be made that the stockholders in the separate, distinct constituent corporations that were being merged, they would turn over their shares to a common trustee who could then operate the constituent firms as a unit. So under the Standard Oil Trust, this consisted of acquiring various smaller firms along the way. The Rockefeller, or whoever he appointed, would control the shares of numerous smaller firms and be able to operate all the firms as one unit. That was the arrangement. Now, these mergers of the trusts, of the corporations by means of trusts, as I put it here in point A, they were necessary to achieve the benefits of improved transportation methods, which favored larger scale manufacturing. I've already pointed out that in the decades following the Civil War, we had the era of tremendous railroad building, steam-powered steel ocean-going ships. And what was the effect of these developments on transportation costs? What do you think the effect of being able to ship your goods by rail to practically any location?
It expanded geographically.
It radically reduced transportation costs. I mean, prior to the railroads, how would you ship goods from one place to another? You'd have to load wagons and imagine fording rivers and so on. You certainly couldn't move very much. And so costs of transportation were very, very high, prohibitive on shipping many goods very far. But with the railroads and ocean-going steam-powered ships, costs of transportation were radically reduced. And this had a major effect. It gave a decisive advantage to large-scale manufacturing over small-scale manufacturing. Because of economies of scale, greater use of specialized tools and machines, more intensive division of labor, large-scale manufacturing will always have, or almost always have, lower manufacturing costs than smaller-scale manufacturing. But those cost advantages, the manufacturing cost advantages, can easily be offset, and more than offset, by disadvantages in costs of transportation. And that's what the following example is designed to illustrate. I ask you in point 7A to assume a large-scale plant has manufacturing cost of $1 per unit, while a small-scale plant has a manufacturing cost of $10 per unit. So if we just considered manufacturing cost, the large-scale plant wins hands down. But now consider the implications of transportation costs for both firms of 50 cents per unit per mile. So assume whatever the product of these two firms is, in order to move it anywhere, it'll cost 50 cents per unit per mile. Now, what does this imply about the radius over which the larger scale manufacturing plant has a delivered cost advantage over the smaller scale plant? Yeah, well, strictly, I think 18 miles. It has a $9 per unit manufacturing cost advantage. How many miles at 50 cents per mile equals $9?
18.
So now, if the smaller scale plant, imagine we have a small scale plant on the spot. It can sell its product on the basis of a $10 manufacturing cost and no transportation cost. Suppose now we have a large-scale manufacturing plant 20 miles away. What will be the delivered cost of the total cost of the large-scale plant's output to the same point, the same location? Well, its transportation cost, if it's 20 miles away, its transportation cost will be what?
$10.
$10, and its manufacturing cost is one. So what's its total cost? 11. So that means the small-scale plant on the spot, all things taken together, has a cost advantage over the large-scale plant, which is more than 18 miles further away. Well, so long as these conditions prevailed, it was not possible to take very extensive advantage of the economies of large-scale manufacturing, because they would be too easily offset within too few miles. And if you're limited to a narrow radius of advantage, it's entirely possible that you won't even achieve very many economies of manufacturing. After all, suppose that you were limited to an 18-mile radius. Well, maybe within an 18-mile radius, you just don't have enough customers to operate your plant at a significant percentage of capacity. You might have a very large-scale manufacturing plant, which if it could operate at 70-80% of capacity, would have very low unit costs. But suppose the circumstances of a very narrow radius of advantage, it only can operate at 10 or 15% of capacity. Well, then its manufacturing cost may be very high too. So such a plant may not even pay to have such a plant at all. But now what happens if we have major developments causing a radical reduction in transportation cost? And so I ask you to assume in the same example that transportation cost is cut to 1 cent per unit per mile. What does this do to the radius of advantage of the large-scale plant? How large is the radius of its advantage now?
Expanded.
900 miles. It can be up to 900 miles further away and still have a total delivered cost advantage. Now, within such a radically enlarged radius of advantage, it's certainly going to be likely to have sufficient customers to operate at a high level of capacity, and probably that sufficient customers for more than one such plant. Well, this radically widens the area over which a large-scale plant can compete and have lower costs. But it's necessary to be able to build the larger scale plants to achieve their economies of scale. And this is what the trusts achieved. The trusts represented a pooling of the assets of a number of smaller scale operations. When the smaller scale firms were merged into one of these trusts, their profits and recovery of depreciation allowances, their cash flows, could be combined and provide sufficient funds to construct larger scale facilities that would achieve these economies of scale. The mergers achieved made it possible to replace inefficient small scale facilities with more efficient large scale facilities. And this was one of the main accomplishments, for example, of the Standard Oil Trust. There's a well-known article that appeared many years ago in the Journal of Law and Economics, which is published by the University of Chicago Law School. And it was called Predatory Pricing, the Standard Oil New Jersey Case. And one of the things the author points out, if I can find the piece quickly enough, one of the things pointed out was that Standard Oil acquired a large number of small refineries. Let me see, I have it here. All right, Standard acquired 123 refineries, many of which also did a marketing business, 11 lubricating oil works, and 24 pipeline concerns. All right, of the refineries it acquired, Standard dismantled at least 75, and ultimately produced a greatly increased volume in only 20 separate installations. So they replaced these 75 small-scale, less efficient installations with 20 much larger installations that could produce at a much lower cost. And to be able to do this, it was necessary to pool the profits and replacement funds of the smaller-scale operations. And Standard Oil, I hope you realize, contrary to popular impression, brought down the price of oil and oil products. And this is apparent even in the Supreme Court decision that broke up Standard Oil. I have a quotation here in point C. In the Supreme Court decision that broke it up, it was said, quote, Much has been said in favor of the objects of the Standard Oil Trust and what it has accomplished. It may be true that it has improved quality and cheapened the cost of petroleum and its products to the consumer. Well, that's a concession. They did that. But then the court finds, but such is not one of the usual or general results of a monopoly, and it is the policy of the law to regard not what may, but what usually happens. Now, this is very ironic because Standard Oil is usually taken as the archetype, the standard of what the trust did, what big business represents. But here we see that in the case that's supposed to be the standard, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen elsewhere either. The price of steel fell. The price of practically everything was reduced as the costs of production were reduced. Okay, well now we're in a position to start to go into the predatory pricing doctrine. I've given you somewhat of a statement of the doctrine, but I have it here too. It's the claim that the large firm can allegedly afford losses which the small firm can't. it can afford them because it's big and rich. The small one can't afford the losses because it's poor and small. And as a result, allegedly, the large firm temporarily slashes its price to force the small firm to sell at a loss in order to drive it out and then jack up prices to higher levels than before. And potential newcomers are supposedly kept out by the threat of further ruinous price cuts. And in the light of such beliefs, all the achievements of the large firms are simply ignored. Anytime they're reducing prices, however much they may make goods more affordable, better, whatever, that tends to be largely ignored because it is perceived as merely a prelude to a gouge. And a good example today would be the fears so many people express about Walmart. If you go into any Walmart store, I think you'll typically find a much wider array of merchandise than you usually find, and at much more economical prices. And this has been the record since the company started. Yet I think this is largely ignored because it's assumed, well, what are these guys really out after? They're just suckering us in, and boy, once they get enough and they put out enough of their competitors, then we're going to be paying prices higher than ever before. And so the accomplishments are pretty much just ignored because they are seen as a kind of predatory pricing. Now, how Walmart got the capital to expand, how it was making profits while selling at predatory prices, no one bothers to explain that. But obviously, they have been making very good profits all these years. That's how they could expand as they have. And so they could not have been practicing predatory pricing up to now if they're making profits every year. All right, well, there are, I go into to problems with the doctrine of predatory pricing. And we have to distinguish between two cases. The first I refer to as the narrow market case, and then the second case will be the broad or wide market case. Now, what I mean by the narrow market case is the situation of chain stores or companies with many different divisions. Here, it's alleged that what happens with predatory pricing is the large firm with many branches will practice predatory pricing in one branch at a time, or only in a few. And it will support the losses in the one branch out of the profits of the others. And so in such a case, where this would apply perhaps would be to A&P. A&P was the major grocery chain in the United States at one time. I don't know how far down the pack they are today, but shortly after World War II, there was an antitrust action against AT&T, claiming it was, A&P, not AT&T. A&P, that stood for Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, claiming it was a monopoly concern. At the time, it was doing about 6% of the retail grocery business of the United States. But the effort, there was an effort made to break it up, and it was believed, this is the kind of argument you would hear, AT&T goes into a new location, it cuts its prices, runs the local mom-and-pop stores out of business, then once they're gone, it jacks up its prices. And they can afford to do this because they have numerous profitable branches with great assets, and here they are. They're competing one-on-one with local mom-and-pop operations, but they have this great fund of assets in all of their other stores and other operations. Okay, well, let's deal with this kind of case. It's argued the big rich firm can bring its great assets to bear and knock off one set of local mom-and-pop operations at a time. All right, I refer to the limited nature of the potential extra profit from any one location, even if it could be obtained. Let me elaborate on this. Suppose after you finish this program, you get a job offer from a hypothetical firm that we'll call Shark Incorporated. And you're employed there, and your first job assignment is, they're in this business, this is their technique, they want to go into different locations, knock off the local competition by running at a loss, and thereafter jack up their prices, go through the whole drill. And your job assignment is to calculate how much of a loss they should be willing to accept as the temporary price of eliminating the local competition. How would you go about calculating how much loss it would pay them to accept? Is there a limit? Is the total loss the whole assets of the firm? Should they contemplate putting up the whole assets of their firm to drive out the local competition? Is that what's available? How much? So let's say here we are, we have $1 billion chain operation, and they're up against a local competitor whose total capital is perhaps $1 million. Now here we are, it's 1,000-to-1 ratio of capital available. Can this large outfit take the attitude, well, you've only got $1 million, and we can afford to lose that many times over? Is there any limit to what they could reasonably afford to lose? And if so, how would you go about calculating it? Well, let's imagine that, let's assume that if they could knock off the local competition and thereafter they become the sole seller in that area, how much extra profit can they make? Can they make billions of dollars a year? There is some delimited extra profit that they could make if they succeed. Let's imagine that if they eliminate the local competition, they could make an extra $100,000 a year from that location. All right, how much is it worth temporarily losing in order thereafter, we'll assume forever, to be able to earn an extra $100,000 a year in profit? Pardon me?
The amount of that perpetuity.
Well, in perpetuity, what's $100,000 a year in an infinite number of years?
After, divided by the going rate.
Pardon me?
$100,000 divided by whatever rate of return.
Well, that if you're talking about the present value of $100,000, that would be much more to the point. The fact that you might make $100,000 extra profit per year in perpetuity, that's, you're not willing to pay $100,000 times 100 years or 1,000 years. That would entail putting up the whole capital of the firm. Ask yourself the simpler question, how much would you be willing to pay today for the right to receive $100,000 one year from today?
Rate was at least.
Would be determined by the going rate of return. So if the going rate of return were, let's say, 10%, if you could expect to earn 10% on $100,000 or whatever it was, how much capital would earn 10% and grow to $100,000 in one year?
90 plus.
Well, it would be a little under 91,000. I think it would be 90,909. You take 10% of 90,909, add it to the principal, you've got 100,000. Okay, how much would you be willing to pay today for $100,000 two years from today to earn a 10% compound annual rate of return? Well, that would work out to something on the order of $81,000. And then $100,000 three years from today. That would work out to something on the order of $72,000. We have a series here, the first term of which is $100,000, the next term, or the first term of our series actually would be $90,000-something, then $81,000, $72,000. If we have an infinite series, the sum of all of the terms will add up, in this case, to 10 times the first number. It'll be $1 million. The present value of $100,000 in perpetuity at a 10% compound annual rate of return is only $1 million. So what does that imply about how much you'd be willing to lose temporarily to gain $1 million, to gain $100,000 extra profit per year in perpetuity? Your firm is worth $1 billion, but how much of the billion would it be rationally pay temporarily to lose to gain an extra $100,000 a year forever if you could actually gain it? Pardon me?
Less than $1 million.
The $1 million would be the absolute maximum, preferably less than $1 million. Would it pay to temporarily lose $2 million to gain an extra profit of $100,000 a year? Now, if you did, then what would be the rate of return you'd make, assuming you could make the $100,000 a year? It would only be 5%. Is that how you grow rich?
No.
No. Okay, so now, here we are. Shark Incorporated has a total capital of $1 billion. How much of that capital is relevant to what they could afford reasonably to temporarily lose in order to wipe out the local competition? Is it the whole billion?
No.
No, it's only the million. It's only the capitalized value of whatever extra profit they could hope they could make. So this is a very important implication. It means that most of the capital of the large firm is irrelevant. See, people have the idea, here's the billion-dollar firm, the poor local competitor, he's so poor, how can he possibly hope to compete? Well, the great bulk of the capital of the big firm is irrelevant. They can't afford to lose that. That's not what's in play. The most they can reasonably afford to lose is the capitalized value of whatever extra profit they might hope to make. Now, if the capitalized value of the extra profit is $1 million, then how many people are in a position to play this kind of game if it could be played? Do you need $1 billion?
No.
No, if you have a couple of extra million, you're in a position to play this. So the idea of the big rich firm, if you analyze it, it loses its teeth. Now further, whoever would attempt to play this way, suppose we have a firm that's the most it could reasonably afford to lose is $1 million. So it goes in, it tries it, and it's lost $500,000. Let's say with $500,000 they could succeed in eliminating the local competition. And now they're hoping to charge premium prices. Well, what danger are they now open to? Someone else can come in, and here they are. They've already expended $500,000. How much left? How much do they have left to lose? If they have $500,000 left, how do they stand compared to the newcomer who hasn't lost anything yet? The newcomer would have the advantage. There is no logical stopping point with this kind of game. Anyone who would attempt to practice it would be open to the same sort of thing by a newcomer who hasn't lost anything yet. Now, a last observation. If this is the way the world worked, if it were the case that the small retailers were just driven out because they had bigger competitors who could afford temporarily to lose money, and then they've jacked up prices, that's why they got rid of them, how should prices today, adjusted for inflation, compare with prices years ago, before the development of the chains? Adjusted for inflation, how should prices still compare? Where would people have gotten a better deal? From the large chains of today or the old small mom and pop retailers? I'm asking the implications of the predatory pricing doctrine. That things should have gotten tougher. We should be paying higher prices in real terms today than in the past. So that when you walk into Circuit City or Best Buy or wherever, your microwave oven, your television set, whatever it is that you buy there, that's costing you more after we adjust for inflation than it did when you were buying from a local little small store. Well, is that the fact or is that the opposite of the fact?
The opposite.
It's the opposite. And the way the large outfits grew was not by throwing money around. They didn't start with the money. Walmart didn't start as a multi-billion dollar operation. It started with one little store. And they made their money by finding better ways to do their job. And they saved and reinvested. And they were offering a better performance on a wider and wider market. And that's the actual way. They achieve lower costs and they charge lower prices permanently. Okay, next week we'll go into the wide market case where the big firm is bigger in the same market. Have a good week.